Welcome aboard, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and open up the today's meeting of the House Resources Committee. Time is 1:06 p.m. on 23 February 2011. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Present are Representatives Gardner, Representative Foster, Representative Munoz, Representative Dick, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. And the purpose of our meeting today is to take up House Joint Resolution Number 9, which is endorsing Anwar Leasing, sponsored by Representative Pruitt, and House Bill 110, Production Tax on Oil and Gas, which is the governor's bill. We will take up House Joint Resolution Number 9 for consideration. And we have folks from Representative Pruitt's staff to present. If you would approach the podium and please give us your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Jenna Krause, staff representative Pruitt. Thank you, Chairman Feige and members of the committee. Today I'm here to present House or HJR 9, which is endorsing Anwar for leasing and development. I know I have a very busy schedule, and we appreciate you taking the time to hear this resolution. House Joint Resolution 9 urges the United States Congress to pass legislation to open the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas exploration and development. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980 prohibited leasing and other development leading to production of oil and gas from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Today, domestic demand for oil continues to rise, while domestic food production continues to fall, with the result that the United States imports additional oil from foreign sources. New technology has greatly reduced the environmental impact of development on the North Slope. If Prudhoe were built today, the footprint would be as small as 1,526 acres. Oil and gas development has also proven it can successfully coexist in Alaska's Arctic. The Central Arctic Caribou Herd at Prudhoe Bay has grown from 3,000 to as high as 23,400 in the last 20 years alone. HJR 9 mirrors previous legislative resolutions and includes provisions for renewable and alternative energy sources, protection of wildlife, and the use of directional drilling. We encourage you to join these past legislative efforts in sending this unified resolution to Congress.
And Mr. Chair, Dirk Kraft, Staff Representative Pruitt, you should all have a proposed committee substitute in front of you. And if it would please the chair, I can go over the changes between version A and the committee substitute version B. To page one, line one, the following language was added to better reflect all of the language included in the resolution. Relating to oil and gas exploration, development, production, and royalties, and relating to renewable and alternative energy technologies. And page 3, line 21 of the original bill, we removed any because it sounded redundant in its usage. And page 3, line 22, and page 4, line 5, we added and alternative after renewable. And page 3, line 29, we added the Alaska State Legislature urges that oil and gas exploration, development, and production for clarification. And I'd be happy to take any questions on those changes or any.
Okay, and it should also be noted that off net we have Mr. Adrian Herrera from Arctic Power who will also be available for questions. Representative Seaton.
That last change, would you tell me what page and line that was?
In the original bill, it was page 3, line 29, but in the proposed CS, it would be page 3, line 28. Let me look at version A. It would be the first further resolved in the proposed committee substitute. So that is page 3, line 28. And we added that the Alaska State Legislature urges that oil and gas exploration, development, and production.
Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we adopt CS for House JR 9 version B as our working document.
As a working document? Representative Gardner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask the sponsor, or rather the sponsor's staff, if they would welcome an amendment to page 2, line 5, where it currently says, whereas the state's future energy independence, and it seems to me that we're talking about more than the state's future energy, but the nation's as well, the state and the nation's.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes, we would definitely be willing to add that language, and that would include.
Thank you, because to me, we're talking about national energies, national security is what it's really.
So what is the amendment you're proposing,
so Representative? Whereas the, I take out apostrophe.
But where in the?
Page 2, line 5, whereas the states, take out apostrophe S and say the state and nation's energy future energy independence. Am I looking on the wrong version?
Are you looking at the right bill?
Sorry, I think I'm just on the wrong, I'm on the A version. So let me just find that on the B version. It's page 2, line 6. Thank you, Linda. Whereas the state and the nation's future energy independence. And just for the chair and the committee, I mean, to me, one of our strongest arguments with Washington, D.C. about ANWR is national security.
Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, we could take that up and address it in a future CS. If I know you have a very busy schedule, if you'd like us to.
I've offered an amendment.
So that's the amendment you're offering?
Yes.
Okay. Any objections to the amendment? Everybody understands the amendment? Mm-hmm. Okay. Hearing no objections, the amendment stands. It should read, whereas the state and the nation's future energy independence. Okay. Representative Munoz.
I have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just recently, we worked on a resolution that we passed out of committee on this same issue, focusing on the 1002 area. Could you speak to the differences contained in this resolution compared to the one that was just passed?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the resolution that was recently passed was specifically opposing wilderness designation in the 1002 area, and this is more general, opening up the ANWR area for development and production.
Any other questions? This time I'd be willing to hear a motion to move this out of committee. Representative Munoz.
I'd like to move CS for House Joint Resolution 9, Version B, from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
I'll object.
Amended?
As amended?
As amended.
I'll remove my objection.
I object. And purposes of, for the record, let's go ahead and make this a roll call vote. Okay. Would you read the roll, please?
Okay, this will be amendment 1.
Excuse me, this is the CS, not the amendment.
Oh, thank you for correcting me. Yes, okay. So the vote is on.
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Kalasaki.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Heron is absent. Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Co-Chair Seaton.
Yes.
Co-Chair Feige.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Eight yeas.
Okay, by a vote of 8-0, we pass CS for House Resolution, or House Joint Resolution 9. Back to the Speaker. We'll take a brief at ease while we pass the paperwork round. House Resources Committee will come back to order. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask for reconsideration of the vote on HGR 9.
Hearing no objections to a reconsideration. Roll call. Entertain a motion to hear it again for reconsideration.
I'd like to move CS for House Joint Resolution 9, Version B, for discussion, please.
Any discussion? Okay. Hearing no objections. Pass it out of committee.
He wanted to roll again, so he'd be on it.
Okay. Secretary, will you call the roll?
You're good when somebody else is.
Mr. Chairman, just wanted clarification. This is HJR 9 as amended from correct. Committee with individual recommendations attached to fiscal. Thank you.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Dick?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Heron?
Yes.
Representative Yanoa?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Fivey?
Yes.
I can add this time. 9 yeas. 0 nays.
Thank you for that courtesy. Mr. Co-Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Heron. And with a vote of 9-0, the resolution will pass. Okay, at this time we will open discussion on House Bill 110. Present in the gallery, we have the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Mr. Brian Butcher, his Deputy Commissioner, Bruce Tangeman, Sherry Nehus from Department of Revenue, Susan Pollard, Assistant AG from the Department of Law, and Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Natural Resources. Anybody have any discussion on House Bill 110? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciated the responses that DOR got back to us February 21st on the questions that were posed on February 2nd or 7th. And the committee has those. I wanted to draw the committee's attention to the DOR's response to number 13, if the committee has that. If not, I'll just read it. And the reason for this is because much of the discussion for this bill has been around the fact that we're uncompetitive with
which one are we looking at?
We are looking at the DOR's February 21st 2011, and the subject is response to questions from House Resources meeting on February 7th.
And let's make sure everybody has that.
Okay.
Before we continue.
And question number 13 is on page 16.
So it's the meeting's response to questions from House Resources meeting February 7th, response dated February 21st. And which page are Representatives?
Page 16.
Page 16. Has everybody got it squared away? Please continue, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on the main reason that's been reported for the bill is that Alaska is seen as uncompetitive with other regions around the world. And the Fraser Report survey was brought in. That's a survey of the industry looking at Alaska's competitiveness. And that slide was specifically talking about Alaska's tax regime, because we all know what we're trying to do is get more oil in the pipeline. And our chief concern is making sure that we're pulling the right lever or getting the response that we want. And so the title of that slide was, if it said 44% of respondents said that Alaska's tax regime deters investment. So what was asked was for a breakdown of that, and you'll see that the breakdown of the respondents on that were 25% says Alaska's tax regime encourages investment. Another 31% said that Alaska's tax regime is not a deterrent to investment. We had 25% that said Alaska's tax regime is a mild deterrent to investment. So when we add those three up, we see that 81% of the respondents from the oil and gas industry identified this tax regime that we have as either encouraging or only a mild deterrent to investment. So the problem becomes is if we're trying to take and run a tax change that would run us into deficit every year after it's fully implemented, and over half of the people say it either encourages or is not a deterrent to investment, and 81% says it's only a mild deterrent or encourages investment. If it's nothing more than a mild deterrent, running ourselves into deficit spending, going up to $2 billion a year from a $2.9 billion tax that we generate, seems like the wrong lever to pull, and that we're not going to get the response that we desire from the oil companies by using this particular vehicle. And so I just wanted to point out that that's DOR's analysis, or not their analysis, but their response to our question of what were the actual responses across the range to the industry's analysis of Alaska's tax regime. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
And just for clarification, that would be 81% of the 56% that responded favorably.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
Go ahead, Mr. Representative.
No. No,
I believe, and we can get DOR up here, but I believe that they have given us the full amount, the full response, because you have the, if you add it up the other way and say 25% and 16% and 3%, you come to their 44%. So this is the full response of the industry. That of which 81% said it was either positive, neutral, or simply a mild deterrent to investment. So that's a full response survey.
I think, Mr. Chair.
Representative Munoz?
I think we need to have that clarified, because the question asks if 44% of respondents to the survey indicated that Alaska's tax regime deters investments, what did the other 56% say? So the answer, I think, focuses on that 56%, but we need to get that clarified.
Yeah, the percentages should be of the total total respondents. In other words, the total number of people surveyed, so 645 people, 44% of those responded that it was unfavorable. So 56% of 645 responded as such. Okay, just a minute. Department of Revenue, can you clarify?
Sure.
What we have here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. This, these numbers do add up to 100. So this is a breakdown of what the 100% is.
Okay. So the breakdown here is of the 645 people surveyed.
Right, the entire pie, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Representative Munoz?
No, that's fine.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson?
So the first two groups, which was the 25% and 31%, those added together come to 56%.
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. These 645 professionals, is there any indication of whether they were actually considering investing in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, our read on this, and obviously we haven't talked to the 600 and some odd folks, but we've done a pretty good job, DNR in particular, of getting information out about the tax credits available in the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of independents that are excited about Alaska as a result of that. Unfortunately, we have examples of companies that have come in, gotten leases, found oil, not been able to find partners, and then abandoned the leases. So when we look at the lack of exploration and the continued decline of oil, you know, you can look at an opinion poll and you can glean some things from it. Certainly we were showing one half of it. We're now discussing the other half of it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change the bottom line of what's going on in the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Representative Gardner?
Thank you. I want to thank Representative Seaton for asking this question. And I think his response was relatively mild. I think it's outrageous. I think this is a distortion of what the study actually concluded. And to give us, it's an illustration of how numbers can be tortured enough to say anything you want. The fact is the survey by a, I believe, an independent nonprofit organization reached a conclusion that was really quite different than what was provided to us, which is the basis on which this legislation is supposed to move forward. And I think it's shocking.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, when we presented the slide, we pointed out that 44% of the respondents, we didn't try to color it in a way that made it sound like everybody that responded looked at Alaska's tax regime in a negative way. We made the point that when talking to 600 and some odd folks, when almost 50% lists either a mild deterrent, a strong deterrent, or would not invest under any circumstances, that those were numbers that we didn't feel comfortable about when discussing Alaska's tax regime.
Okay. Chair, I need to respond, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And through the chair, it's accurate in the detail, but I think Alaskans would want to know that another way of looking at these exact same numbers is 81% said Alaska's tax regime encourages investment, is not a deterrent to investment, or is simply a mild deterrent to investment. That's a big impact.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, you could also look at it as 25% encourages investment, and 75% said it's either a negative or not a deterrent. I mean, it just depends on how you want to look at the numbers. But I appreciate the point you're making.
So the first thing I learned when I went to grad school was the statistics class. And how you can make the numbers reflect about anything you want to, I suppose. So Any other discussion? Representative Day.
If I understand right, where I think what we're trying to do here is that we have, I mean, if I was one of them, you know, I'd be counted as, you know, one of those that had an opinion, but my potential to develop oil would probably be way smaller than one of the big three. So it seems to me that if we're really going to get an accurate, make an accurate decision here, we would even have to weight each one of these in terms of their potential, and then we would have an accurate assessment as to, because if, say, this 25% thought the encourages investment, and they're all so tiny they wouldn't matter, we're giving them the same weight as somebody who might put billions into investment in exploration. So as I'm trying to get my head around this, it seems that this doesn't come close to give me a true picture either.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, I would agree with that. We get a lot of questions about how we compare, how folks view Alaska, and so we were trying to provide information on what that is. By no means were we stressing that this was, you know, a foolproof way of looking at it. This was just a piece of information. We knew that many of the companies that are investing or looking at investing in Alaska would be giving their perspective on it, and that would give you far more of a companies that are operating or considering operating in Alaska view of it than, you know, kind of what we're viewing. But it was just kind of an anecdotal piece because we do get asked that question. How do people view Alaska?
Is there any indication what the peak? Obviously, this study didn't break it down, but do we have an idea of how the people that actually own leases in the state of Alaska feel?
Mr. Chairman, I can't determine
it from this study.
No. Okay. Other than what you heard in committee.
We did hear a lot, didn't we? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for everybody's information, the Fraser Institute is surveying the industry. So this is not people off the street. This is people that are involved in looking at investing in this industry. They also do it on mining industry, and they survey the miners. They don't ask the oil companies about the mining tax. They don't ask the miners about the oil. So this is not a random survey off the street or something. So. But if our basis for this is that our perception in the industry is that Alaska's tax system makes this an unfavorable place to invest, the data is that the majority don't view it that way, and in fact the vast majority think that it's either favorable, not a factor at all, or a mild deterrent. And again, the question is do we want to pull the lever that is shown as being not very much effect on the industry's attitude towards investing in Alaska? And that is the point that we should be looking at, not the absolute details of the survey, I believe.
And it should be noted this is one survey among many that are out there, I'm sure. Not to mention the actions of companies over the past 3 years. Representative?
And Mr. Chairman, I think that if we look at the AOGCC slide on either production wells, or if you look at the one on exploratory wells, you will see the colors that are becoming magnified in our recent years since we have ACES, because there are many more companies that are now exploring and producing in Alaska. It used to be we had three, basically.
Excuse me, Representative Seaton?
Yeah.
Which slide are you referring to?
The AOGCC slide that was presented to us about a week and a half ago.
Do you have a copy of it?
Take a brief, Patty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you go through number 10 on page 8 that you presented to us so that does that I don't see the question says I guess it says what the cost of gas would have to be, but I was just wondering if it all goes into effect and it's taken advantage of, is what you thought that maybe how much we wouldn't be getting into the state coffers that we normally would. So I have something to compare in my head whether it's worth it or not or whatever.
Sure, Representative, which of the...
February 23rd letter. And it's the one that says response to questions from House Resources meeting on February 21st.
Okay.
And then on page 8, 21st. Number 10.
Okay,
so it's the response to questions from House Resources on February 21st. The letter's dated February 23rd. Everybody got it?
No.
Number
10.
Found it. This will be on page 8, item number 10.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, what this is basically saying is if the bill were to pass today, it wouldn't have an effect on the FY12 budget because the effective date takes place in the future. If it was... it ramps up if it was a full fiscal year, and I believe that was the intent certainly of what the question was. It would be approximately $90 to $92 a barrel to balance what's been submitted for the governor's budget for fiscal year 12.
Representative Wilson.
So would that be it would have to be $90 to $92 a barrel more than it is now?
No. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, $90 to $92 a barrel for the fiscal year.
For the full.
That would be the cost of the price of oil for that fiscal year. It wouldn't be in addition to anything. That's just if without this bill passing, it would be $81 a barrel. With the bill passing, meaning taking out the credits and with the tax reduction, it would be $90 to $92 a barrel.
Okay. Follow up.
Representative Wilson.
So then it's really it would the cost is going to be $12 a barrel about.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, for this fiscal year, $9 to $11.
All right, thank you. And so whoever asked the question didn't ask what a full year would be, but that's for a half a year?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that would be for a full fiscal year.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Representative Seaton, are you
ready? There you go. No, I was following up on Representative Wilson's question.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Representative Wilson.
Follow up. So you're saying that's what it would cost, even though it's not going to be in effect yet?
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative.
So even when it's not into effect, it's going to cost us $12 a barrel. And then when it is in effect, what would it cost about?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if the changes in HB 110 were in full effect for the fiscal year, it would be a $9 to $11 increase in the price of oil you would need to balance the FY12 budget.
Okay.
In other words, oil would have to be everything else the same.
Well, no. If it's going to cost us $12 a barrel when it's not into effect, then when it is into effect, it's going to cost us more.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, under the current scenario, $81. If this were in effect, fully in effect now, instead of the current law, it would be $90 to $92. So the difference between the status quo and the passage of this bill, if it were in full effect for the fiscal year, would be $9 to $11.
Because that's not what you said to begin with. I just want to understand that I'm understanding you. The $12 a barrel, that is if it was in effect, fully in effect for a full year.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct.
Okay.
$9 to $11.
All right, thank you.
Do you still have a follow-up for her?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You know, we just got this when we came in here. So can you provide us your calculations on how this is arrived at so we can analyze this? And I appreciate it because we're not showing the difference in the revenue between the two for the year. We're just showing how much underwater we would be.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we would be happy to provide you that information. I also, if I could, Mr. Chairman, would like to apologize to the committee for getting the turnaround on this hasn't been as fast as we had hoped. It's a lot of information we've been trying to come up with, and our turnaround from the Monday meeting obviously was pretty quick, but for the previous days, it took longer than we would have hoped.
Understand. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, if we need $9 to $11 of additional revenue to balance the budget, if HB 110 were in place, what is the equivalent dollar amount of $9 to $11 a barrel?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I'm not sure I understand your question.
How much revenue does $9 to $11 per barrel represent?
I see what you're saying. It would, through the chair, it would be, that's what would have to, that's the per barrel price that would be required to get to the same dollar amount. Because we're comparing the size of the governor's amended budget, and so looking at the two scenarios, they both have to come up to what the governor's budget is. So they both come up to the same dollar amount. It's just a matter of how the taxes affect it, which determines whether we need more per barrel or less per barrel, if that makes any sense.
Well, thank you. Just I'm trying to understand what the real dollar impact is, because we hear differing reports of what the real dollar impact would be. And so if I think if you look at the current budget based on last year's barrel, price per barrel, we're bringing in roughly $5.5 billion, I believe. What is the impact based on those numbers of $9 to $11 a barrel going forward?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I think the approximate number would be approximately a little under to a little over $1 billion in production tax, and then you add to it the $200 to $400 million estimate. So I think you're looking at between $1 billion to $1.4 billion maybe.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Seaton, you want to address your charge?
We're getting the second one reproduced.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Any other points of discussion? Take a brief at ease while we're waiting for copies. Order.
Oh, you're right.
Representative Wilson has a question for the commission.
Okay, thank you. And I think he asked it in one of these, but anyway, explain to me the tax credits that they will get that are more than before. And I know we don't have an idea of what that's going to be, but you based it on at least some premise that you thought it would be, or, you know. So could you tell us with the tax credits that I guess that's money that we wouldn't be getting into the state, but just to justify the reasons that you made the tax credits the way you did?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the increased credits in the bill would be a 40% credit for well lease expenditures on the North Slope. Right now, it's 20% on the North Slope and 40% in the rest of the state. And this would move it from 20% up to 40%, which we believe would help increase investment. And our estimate, our rough estimate on how that would affect the state would be approximately $200 to $400 million annually. And Sherry Nienheis, our petroleum economist who worked on that piece of the fiscal note, is here if you'd like more detail.
Just one follow-up. So it right now it's currently 200 million to 400 million, and so this would be another 200 because it's going to go up to 40% instead of 20%?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this would be an additional 200 to 400 on top of what we have currently. Okay. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, as we're talking about this, thank you. I discussed the number for what the progressivity would be on a change from monthly to annual at the last meeting, and I estimated 100 to 400 million, which is not an inaccurate number. However, I was thinking about what the number was under the current scenario with the high marginal rates. Under this bill, switching to brackets, it would be much, much smaller, in the probable tens of millions as opposed to hundreds of millions. So it's a number, certainly one to discuss, but very small compared to what the number is under the current law.
And these companies would not get this credit unless they spent money in the first place, correct?
For this, Mr. Chairman, for this particular annual to monthly, it applies to the companies that are producing on the slope and paying taxes.
I get a little confused when we go from nominal to all those other ones. The one you showed in here is the nominal tax rate, the current one, and how it changed to when you bracket it for ACEs, and it doesn't look like there's any difference. And I'm sure there is a difference.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it looks like what you're looking at was a question Representative Heron had asked about what would it look like if we bracketed the current law and without any tax reductions that were included in this bill. And that pretty much speaks to the cap that's put in at 50% as opposed to 75%. So you're going to see the bracket continue to go up as opposed to plateauing at 50%.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were talking about the number of people that came to Alaska to invest in oil exploration, and we have two slides that look like this from AOGCC's presentation that they delivered to our offices. And the one, although there's some writing on it showing where ACEs and where PPT, handwritten, where those started. The point that we were talking about at this point in time was not the decrease of production wells before ACEs or PPT occurred, but what we were doing was looking at the number of people that were doing investment wells, and that's given by the colors. So if you look at the colors at the left-hand side, you'll see there were only basically three companies doing any production wells, and as you go across, you'll see there's more colors because there's more players that are producing drilling production wells. The more explanatory one would be the exploration well permits from AOGCC, and you can see again on the left-hand side that there are very few colors because we had very few people exploring. And then starting in about 2002 and then moving up rapidly through 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, you'll see a very wide diversity of color because there are more oil companies drilling or getting the exploratory well permits. Now, this is permits, and sometimes we get confused between permits and wells. So if I could also draw members' attention to the DOR response from February 23rd to the meeting on February 21, page 6, where it's talking about exploration wells drilled on the North Slope. So these are ones that are actually completed. And if we exclude the projected, because that's not there, and look at the 4 years after ACES was employed and the 4 years before ACES came into existence, you find that the average is that there's been 12 wells drilled, exploration wells drilled, in those 4 years after ACES was instituted, and there were 7.8 wells, average drilled exploratory wells, for the 4 years preceding ACES. Now, everything has positives and negatives, and you can have reasons for one or reasons for another, but the data shows that the exploration well permits, and then the 4 years that have been completed after ACES, we had more exploratory wells drilled on the average for those 4 years than we had for the 4 years preceding ACES, that is 2003, 4, 5, and 6, and then ACES being 2007, 8, 9, and 10. That's just the data that's in the DOR report to us.
If I could point something out here, maybe you're not seeing this, or maybe I'm seeing it differently, but where we have all the variety of new explorers coming into the Alaska, the price of oil spikes up there about $135. In fact, the general trend in price from 2001 to 2002, where it's down below $20 a barrel, seems to be generally upward. And also, your slide there with the exploration wells, the blue one, could you pull that up again?
Sure. Yeah, we notice we have a pretty good spike there. What's about 2007, 2008? Mr. Hurley, would you be able to answer sort of a general oil industry question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to say that I want to make sure that we're looking at the data as what those averages are, and not just explanations of why the averages are where they are.
Well, that's fine. It's a pretty general question. In the oil, if you would, name for the record.
For the record, my name is Michael Hurley. I'm the Director of Government Relations for ConocoPhillips in Alaska and Anchorage.
In general, based on your experience in the oil industry, the decision, from the time a decision is made to drill a well to the time the well actually gets drilled, on average, on the North Slope, would be about how many years?
Mr. Chairman, from the time you go to plan a well, you have to go and do permitting. You have to do some environmental work, some site clearance. Quite often you'll have to do an ice road if you're going out into an area where you don't have development. The timing will vary. The quickest it will usually be somewhere on the order of 18 months. But that period, based on seasonality and when you make the decision, because you may have to wait for the season to be able to go out and put an ice road, it can be up to 2.5 years.
So on average, about 2 years?
On average, probably 2 years.
In the industry, typically what happens, once a decision to drill has been made, do companies in the short term change their plans based on things that may be happening in the economy, with the price of oil, with all the factors that go into deciding whether or not to drill a well in the first place? In other words, once you've headed down the path, do you typically head down the path, or do you, stop it at any time?
Mr. Chairman, quite often it will depend on the nature of the decisions. An example of a case where your committed and you go through with it anyway might be the development that Pioneer did over at Agouric. Mm-hmm. They were actually sunk into that quite a ways before the tax laws changed in 2007, and I think they were in a position where there was a point of no return. Once you've sunk a certain amount of money into a project or into a development, oil companies will always look at the economics point forward. It's like, whatever you've done is done. What are the economics of putting the next dollar in and continuing the development to its fruition? So once you get to a certain point and you've got enough dollars sunk into the process, whether it's a development or an exploration well, you're always going to look at it point forward. So you will quite often continue, if you've already got dollars sunk in, you'll continue to do something despite what economic conditions may be at the time, because you're always looking point forward in your economics.
Let me get this straight. So the high spikes, if you could hold the graph up again there, the high spikes in 07, 08, those decisions to drill were actually, on average, were made probably in 05, 06?
Mr. Chairman, that's quite likely.
Okay, so the decision to drill the wells that were in 09 and 10, those decisions were made in 07 or, yeah, 08, 09?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Something like that? Okay. Representative Wilson.
Following that same train of thought, we could kind of get a better picture of this then if we just slid the numbers over, the years over, by 2 years. So in other words, what says happened in 2008, that was because of what decisions that were made in 2006.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, generally on average that's true. As I said earlier, a lot of it depends on the particular decision you're making and where you are relative to seasonality of things like putting in the ice roads and doing the kind of pre-work that you need to do to be able to go out to a new site.
Follow-up?
Representative.
All right, now, I'm looking at when ACES was enacted, and so I'm probably thinking in my head here a little bit that I'm not going to look at the next 2 years, because that probably where we were at or you guys were at, and you couldn't maybe make the changes that quick. You had to go follow through. So I'm not going to look at those next 2 years, but the next year I might look at it and say ACES came into effect. It looks like if I go 2 years and not pay attention to the next 2 years, but then the next year, which is a big drop here, that's probably the process. Or, and I want to follow this up with a question for you, what if you guys decide that the risks are too high because of ACES, whatever was in ACES, how long does that take you when you go to your headquarters that aren't in Alaska, wherever they're at worldwide, and say, okay, we want you to invest here, but there's other places that you can invest, and they say, sorry, but we're not going to invest in Alaska because this is a better deal over here, and so they shift. How long does that shift take for us to see it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, when we go through and do our budgeting process, we go through and budget pretty much every year and look at and rank opportunities that are out there for either exploration or development every year as we go through a budget process. The interesting thing I would remind the members of is, you know, we talk about 2007 when ACES passed. It was actually like November 11th, somewhere around there. It was like the end of the year. So we really weren't, we were already committed to things we were going to do in 2008. And partially into 2009 at the point when ACES actually passed. The budgetary process that we go through usually starts, for example, with exploration stuff in the spring and runs basically, it often feels like we're budgeting all year round. You go from one budget cycle to the next. But you try and do those kinds of rankings of your project each year, and once you've committed to one, actually signed AFEs, and you're committed to it, then it becomes part of the ongoing budget in the subsequent years if it's a long-term development. But for things like exploration wells or things that are short-term decisions about do you drill that next well or not, those things will usually fall through that budget cycle and get ranked. So it starts in the spring about something you may not do till the next spring.
That still gives us about, yeah, it does. It kind of still gives us about 2 years. Okay, thank you.
Representative Seed.
So, Mr. Chairman, on the exploratory well permits that we have, ConocoPhillips in 2007 only drilled one exploratory well. So that decision was made in 2005, and Conoco basically quit exploration decisions prior to PPT or ACES, because PPT was 2006. And so I'm just trying to follow your reasoning so that the zero exploratory wells by BP in 2003, 2004, 2005, and only one in 2006, those lack of any wells being drilled, exploratory wells by BP, were decisions that were made under the previous fiscal regime with very low production tax and were not related at all to PPT or ACES. Those were just decisions that when taxes were low, those two companies decided not to drill exploratory wells. Is that, if we back up 2 years, is that what you're telling us?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that I follow your chain of logic. I can't speak for BP or for ExxonMobil. Paul would hit me in the head if I did that. But there are decisions that companies will make about exploration strategy, and they may have made those kinds of decisions in those time frames. I can't speak to it.
And, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. Ms. Hurley. In 2007, it does show that you did drill one well, but the year after, it looks like you drilled three. The year before, you drilled four. Was there any particular reason?
Mr. Chairman, it's always about the availability of opportunities and where you see rocks. And
okay.
Sometimes there are projects that are ready to drill. Sometimes it takes several years' worth of seismic work, acquiring land positions in the lease sale so that you know that you've got the land where you want to drill. Those kinds of things sometimes take time. So it takes years to develop a prospect to the point where it is ready to be drilled.
So 07 just may have been an aberration, you're just between projects.
It could easily have been, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. And, you know, it is basically difficult to try to categorize all different companies and their individual decisions. But if we want to say we're going to back up 2 years, then I think the best way to look at it is to look at the development service wells, because there we're not looking at whether those you have the land or you have to do the access. And you see that in 2006 is where it dropped. So we actually, as prices were rising, we see that the companies that were in-field drilling dropped in 2005 and 2006 and 2007 were low numbers of production wells, in-field drilling, where you're not looking for the resource. And that was not obviously driven by consideration of a profit tax rate, because that was before we had the profits tax. So the question is, if those were the lowest years and were with generally rising oil prices, the philosophy of this bill is if we drop our tax rate back to what it was then, we're going to get some different response than what they decided to do back when they had those tax rates. And the tax rates in 03 and 04 on rising oil prices on the two-year lag produced the lowest levels of production well drilling that we've seen on the North Slope, having nothing to do with ACEs, but that's where we are testifying we need to get most of our production from. The exploration wells brings new players into the field, as you can see with all of the multicolors that are coming on the other chart. When those players are acquiring leases and those kind of things is probably a longer lead time. But the developmental wells is, you know, I mean, it's just pretty obvious that they drop to the lowest levels they've been basically in history since 1999, just after the oil price crash in our state's history, and that was not based at all on the profit tax or on the level of profit tax. So it just appears that that's the wrong lever to pull to get our desired goal of more oil in the pipeline based on the number of developmental wells that are being drilled in the fields.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think this is a simpler question, but if you had received the NPRA permits that you expected to have by now, would your company, do you think, be drilling exploration wells this year?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, actually, there wouldn't need to be exploration wells for the things you were talking about in CD5,
uh-huh.
In particular. That is actually a development opportunity rather mm-hmm. than an exploration opportunity. We've already drilled the discovery wells and mm-hmm. delineated okay. it. We know it's there. It's simply a question of can we get out there and develop it. And right now, two things are yet outstanding. One is we actually haven't signed and committed the AFE to do the development because we're waiting on the permit.
AFE,
authorization for expenditure.
Thank you.
It's the actual document that companies sign mm-hmm. and get the rest of the co-owners to sign that actually commit you to a development. So we're waiting to see how that permit comes through from the Corps of Engineers, and then we have to make a decision about whether the economics still stand up for that particular project, given whatever stipulations are on that permit and the conditions at the time.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Just a note on the exploratory well permits draft. You mentioned that the number of entrants into the field seem to be increasing over time. Going back to 1996, I show four different companies engaged in exploration, and obviously going into the mid-2000s, that expanded quite a bit. But looking at 2010, looks like we're back to five different companies. So five permits. Now, granted, these are permits, but only one well is drilled out of those five permits. So it seems like some of the smaller players, and some of these names I recognize from work that I did up north. These are all former customers that have since, a lot of them are former customers that have pulled out. And this also includes Cook Inlet folks as well. Just a point. FEX has sold, they drilled a number of exploration wells in NPRA, and they've since plugged and abandoned and turned leases back into the state. Fowler Oil and Gas never got off the ground. It was a coal bed methane developer in the Mat-Su Valley. Renaissance has not they folded up shop and went home. I think they're still out there, but kind of on paper. Just a couple of the ones I noticed. Representative Seed.
Just a correction from the data that was provided from DOR. There were three wells drilled in 2010, not one. One is the projected for 2011.
Two of those were Point Thompson. Any other questions? Representative Gardner.
On a topic going back a little bit, I think Representative Wilson asked about the analysis of the fiscal note number one. And if I understand correctly, she was asking about the balance point in the year 2013 of how much the...
What exactly are you referring?
I'm looking at fiscal note number one. The analysis and section three, where it calculates the change when the tax rate is calculated annually rather than monthly, and that the revenue impacts are listed for each.
What?
I'll show you what it looks like.
Okay, brief it is. Figure out what it is.
So the question is this. In the out year, say to 2017, how much would the price of oil per barrel have to be to balance this budget in 2017?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I can get back to you on that later today, but okay. Off the top of my head, I can't crunch the numbers on, you know, I have it all in front of me, production and everything, but...
I understand.
We'll absolutely get that to the committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a question, then? You want to ask him that? Why don't you just ask him?
Okay. Are we back on?
We are back on. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, and I think this follows through with what Representative Gardner was saying. And today it's got February 23rd, 2011, and it looks like this, and it's stapled together. And on the last part, it looks like this. So if you take that first, there is a difference on the. Because on the first fiscal note, the explanation is in the back. It tells you what year and how much money, and then it shows this one, and this one does show quite a difference from that first one. So the other one was like for fiscal year 2013, it was minus 300 and something, and this one says minus 582 to minus 782. So. Right. So that has been adjusted, and that's what I was wondering about. Yeah. I knew that there was a change, and
through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's the same numbers that come from the analysis section of the fiscal note. The analysis section of the fiscal note just kind of took it issue by issue, and this puts it into a spreadsheet, basically, that's much easier to understand and looking at than to kind of work through the narrative of the fiscal note as submitted.
Oh, I see.
I'd also like
these,
that.
These numbers are right off the fiscal note right there.
Okay.
And these are, well, these expenditure credits on top of that.
Okay, that's
included there.
Right, that's what we wanted. And yes. I appreciate this because this gives us a real life look at what the ramifications are.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative.
I'm trying to get my head around this, and I'm visual. In my mind, I see two simultaneous equations. One, if from your vantage point, if the graph goes, if the oil at $90 a barrel, our income is going to decline because the production declines. What we're talking about here is reducing that income for a time, so that at some point that graph will either increase or decline at a lower rate. My question, given the best-case scenario for the, for exploration, say we get everything we want, the exploration takes place, where do those two lines cross? How many years down the road, with the best-case scenario, and there's an area between them, that is, the money we will have lost. And then my next question is, extrapolating beyond that, how far do we have to go down the road before we just recover that which we've lost?
Through the chair, Representative Dick, we've done work on that. There are so many different variables that you would work into that it's difficult to determine where that is. We would be happy to work with the committee or certainly work with you or others individually on kind of working through some possible scenarios to figure out where that is, but I would have a difficult time kind of trying to make an estimate on where those lines would cross, because the lines, depending on the price of oil, as an example, you know, the price of oil is up over $100 today. If it was up to $120, $130 for a couple of fiscal years, it's going to completely change these numbers, just as it would if it went the other direction and the price of oil dropped to $50 a barrel. It would make it, and so we won't know that. We'd be happy, like I said, to sit down with you, but it's complex enough that even if we were to come forward with an estimate on our best guess, you know, you'd be able to question basically every assumption we made.
But it's, excuse me, follow up.
But Representative.
It seems to me, as I try to get my head around this, even if we just stuck with $90 a barrel, that would help me picture in my mind. And as I picture it in my mind, it seems to me that where the lines would cross might be 3-4 years down the road. And it might be another 4 years down the road beyond that before we even met up with having, you know, we would have gained that which we've already invested into this. So it seems to me that the actual, at best case scenario, maybe 8 or 9 years before we could even recover or break even with what we're talking about, are willing to sacrifice for this.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, yeah, it would certainly be a number of years, and a lot would determine on how quickly the increased exploration and development that we anticipate with this bill would occur. It would have to do with what size fields are being found and a lot of that stuff. We could be pleasantly surprised or not.
Mr. Commissioner, I've only been here a little over a month now, and I haven't found a crystal ball that worked in the Capitol. I gather you don't have one over in your office either.
Unfortunately, I do not, Mr. Chairman. if I could add, Mr. Chairman, we have...
Go ahead, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. We have Joe Balash, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, here today. There had been some discussion in the committee about what represents a unit, because the discussion is, you know, the 15% tax rate outside of a unit, and he is prepared to kind of walk through the evolution of it from exploration to a unit if the committee's interested.
It kind of goes back to, Mr. Bart Armfield from Brooks Range, mm-hmm. kind of brought that issue up during his testimony. I'd be happy to hear it. Mr. Balash?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. The Commissioner alluded to, there were some issues raised last Friday in testimony regarding units and the types of units that are out there. And so just wanted to provide the committee a brief overview of how the state's system works for putting our land into lease, and then from leases into units, from units into participating areas, and how sort of the life cycle of a lease occurs and moves over time and you know, either into exploration or into production or comes back through the system. If you look at the map here on the big wall, all of the areas in blue are areas that are state land. And the state then has the right to make its land available to lessees. And so we divide up blocks of land into individual leases and make those leases available at competitive sales once every year. We have broken down the oil and gas prone areas into five areas. That is the Beaufort Sea, the North Slope, the foothills, the Cook Inlet, and the Alaska Peninsula. So we have five area-wide sales that occur each year at different times throughout the year. And all of the available land, all of the available leases in an area are available at that area-wide sale for bid, minimum bids with minimum qualifications on the part of the bidders to come in and acquire those leases. Once a lease is provided to a company, they have a primary term, a certain number of years that can be no more than 10 under state law, in which the company may go out and explore that. They have the exclusive right to go and explore on that lease. And so when they get to the end of that 10 years, if they have not obtained a certified well or successfully put that lease into production, the term ends, the lease terminates, it comes back to the state and gets a new lease number and is available at the next area-wide lease sale. In the event that the lease is drilled, oil is found, the lease itself is unlikely to be the only place where the oil is located. There are very likely going to be additional leases to the north, south, east, and west that also contain oil. And so the unitization process is a means by which you can more efficiently develop a pool of oil underlying multiple leases. And so it's more than one lease. It's a collection of leases that are grouped together, put into a unit, and then a single operator then is identified to develop that unit. There are a couple of ways a unit can be formed. One is through the Division of Oil and Gas, particularly if it relates to state land. Another is through the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And a third is by the federal government. BLM, in administering federal lands, particularly in the NPRA or some portions of the Cook Inlet. And within the state system, they can be formed and filed at the Department of Natural Resources if the unit contains all state acreage or some state acreage. And it just sort of depends on the particular situation. But once that unit is petitioned and agreed to be formed by the Division of Oil and Gas, what has to be provided then is either a plan of exploration or a plan of development. If the oil in the unit has been delineated and is ready to be produced, a plan of development is submitted that lays out the facilities that need to be constructed and the time in which it will be constructed and put into production. If, however, all that is present in the unit is a discovery, then additional drilling needs to be done to delineate the oil field or pool to identify specifically how big or how much oil is there. And so a plan of exploration is submitted that guides the development or delineation of the field, and the division is able to track what is going on and make sure that it is occurring. If the unit does not go into production within 5 years, the unit then is subject by law to terminate, in which case any leases within the unit that have gone beyond their primary term, those leases then terminate and go back into the pool for the area-wide lease sale that next occurs. So under the regulations at the Division of Oil and Gas, there is no distinction between an exploration unit or a development unit. There are simply units. It's just a matter of whether or not you are operating under the terms of a plan of exploration or a plan of development. But that, you know, that's starting to get down into some weeds that probably for this discussion aren't all that necessary to go into. Once you have a specific unit formed and you have a pool of oil or a reservoir identified within that unit, what then happens is a participating area is defined for purposes of identifying the exact location of where that area is. A participating area is typically and almost always smaller than the unit. You can have multiple participating areas within the unit, but what happens then is once the participating area has been formed within the unit, any leases within the unit that are not part of the participating area then get contracted out of the unit. In other words, the any leases within that larger block of units that were contained in the original formation of the unit but ultimately do not have oil on them or delineated oil within them or gas would then be subject to contraction. They get kicked out of the unit unless there is a plan of exploration to further explore those leases within the unit. Again, if the leases are at the end of their primary term, they terminate and go back into the general pot for the area-wide lease sale, and when they're made available for releasing, they get a new lease number. It's like the clock got reset on them, and they're 21 all over again. So, that's a very simplified version of the process that we go through at the Division of Oil and Gas in the Department of Natural Resources to manage our leases, the differences between a lease, a unit, participating area, and how a lease can be put back into the mix and available for competitive bidding. So if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that explanation. Let me see if I can get the terminology correct to ask my question. So if a participating area is formed into a unit and there are areas there that are kicked out because they're not going to be used, and later on, suppose somebody comes along and says, I can make that pay, and they bid on that lease, are they automatically part of the operating area, or are they kind of on their own within a participating area?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, let me try and add a couple of wrinkles here for you to make sure I have the right scenario here. If a given lease that is originally part of a unit but ultimately is contracted out, then becomes available in a lease sale and somebody new comes along and picks up that lease, the unit boundary when the lease is originally contracted out, the unit boundary shrinks down to just the leases that are in the unit. So a unit will start off big and shrink down to the size roughly of the PA or the plan of exploration for any other leases that aren't part of the PA. So a PA is a subset of the unit. A participating area is a subset of the unit within the larger box.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
So given geology, it's unlikely that someplace within a unit that's actually being would be taken out because the geology is such that it would be developed with everything else. The participating unit doesn't have holes in it, gaps. It's all connected.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, within the collection of leases in the unit, you may have more than one PA, and you may have some gaps where there are leases that aren't part of a PA. But where those gaps occur require a plan of exploration. There has to be some plan to do something with those leases. So it's either subject to a POE or it's part of a PA. And if it's neither, it goes back out into the pool of available leases.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And if you have that written, if
if you could. I was seeing you read something, so if it's written out, it would be helpful to us to have it in our findings.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I can provide you my crib notes, or I can provide you a 50-page PowerPoint.
The crib notes would be
crib notes would be great.
Okay. Thank
you. So, Representative Seaton. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues that was identified earlier, and then we had the department give us previous Gaffney-Klein from 2007, I believe, presentation on looking at our jurisdiction, state of Alaska, and other oil and gas jurisdictions around the world. One of the things that we had noted from testimony and is pointed out specifically in that comparison document is that we are not competitive or not equal to other jurisdictions in our requirement for submission of data on leases and participating units that are on state land. And I'd like to find out from the department what data we would like to have included in the what would be valuable for the state of Alaska to have in future for leases and for participating units and units from a DNR perspective as to what's valuable, and also a analysis of the time for confidentiality that the state would propose as being the reasonable length of time for that to remain confidential, and when it would become, and especially whether the state feels that if there's an abandoned lease, that any data that was generated on that lease should be the property of the state. So if you could provide, I'm not asking for it right now off the top of your head.
Thank you.
But we are quite interested in that to make us more generally competitive, to also have the data so that if leases are abandoned, we can lower the costs of future development based on the money that we've paid in exploration tax credits and those kind of things, that we generate the data and have that so that we can actually lower the cost of future development of our state resources. So if you could provide both co-chairs and we can distribute it to the committee. But I think that'd be valuable from DNR.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I want to make sure I understand the request, and there are a variety of pieces of information that you can collect on a given lease. There is seismic data you can collect. There's G&G data you collect when you actually drill a penetration. Geologic geotechnical information that you can collect that is actually from the subsurface as opposed to bouncing the seismic waves off of the structure. So Are you asking for anything and everything? There's another line that we draw in the treatment of information that has to do with interpretation by the lessee or a contractor for the lessee. And so do you want to look at the whole schmear of information, the whole spectrum, or what is it that you would like us to identify?
Thanks, John.
Representative Seed?
What I'd like to do is see us being competitive and gaining the same kind of information that the major producers and the explorers give to the other jurisdictions around the world, and whether that Gaffney-Klein document said field-by-field data is done, those kind of things. So if it would be helpful for us to have the same as the UK or the same as Norway, if we could find out what it would be helpful and reasonable for the state of Alaska to require to be provided to the state from DNR perspective. And I'm not a oil geologist, and I'm not asking for data that DNR would not want to use or wouldn't find valuable to have if a lease is abandoned. Of course, we couldn't require data that they hadn't gathered, but if they've gathered seismic data, then it would seem like that would be data that should become available to the state. So I'm asking DNR to use their expertise to define that. My thumbnail thing is looking at other jurisdictions that are not that are not, you know, I'm not talking about a third world country. I'm talking about Norway, UK. I think there were several others that were analyzed by the report that was done for the state of Alaska. And if those, but it's not specific enough in there for me to understand exactly what that is. So if you would let us know what would be valuable for us to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Balash. Is that a general question for Commissioner? Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I guess I need a sort of a broad overall question. We've had some very specific questions, detailed questions that you've have in your best, at best, I mean, you're trying your best to explain them both in written and verbal. But my friend here from Canyon on the Stony River, I'd like to do like a visual question. And so there's many strident views on this. One saying it's a giveaway, and others say it's very well needed. And there's a lot of us that are, of course, learning, including myself, and we have open minds about it. So the governor has met with many of us, and, you know, his views on this are well chronicled, what he wants. And I take that for what it's worth, and his concerns are legit. And many people have testified here always give caveats, no guarantees, et cetera. And the correspondence that we've received to our respective office is, they've hit us pretty hard. And some are saying this is a huge leap of faith by the governor, and then the governor is asking Alaskans to make this huge leap of faith. You know, our career started out the same, you as a kid, me as middle-aged, and so we're still here. And so we're going to consider amendments. The co-chairs, that's up to them to when we're going to do that. But, you know, so maybe the bill gets amended. So do you believe right now, without those amendments, do you believe this proposed legislation that the governor wants, it's your reputation as well as the governor's, is this legislation the correct size parachute for Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, in my opinion, it is. As we sat down in forming this, discussions with the governor, discussions with the industry, trying to determine what we needed to do to get things turned around, we dug, and you're going to dig into the details in this committee and every committee, and things can be analyzed one way or the other, and the one thing we kept coming back to is one of the few things that we do know definitively. We know there is oil up there. We know that our production continues to decline in the state. We know that with the price of oil going up, exploration has risen in many states considerably over the last few years, and it has not here. And, I think that that's kind of the snapshot we were looking at when we started digging into this and came up with what we believed was our best idea to move the state forward and to move this forward. Certainly we're going to go through amendments. Certainly there's going to be changes. And the governor's aware of that as well. But I think the three main pieces of this that, the 15% for new explorers, the change to brackets for progressivity, and the 40% well credits for the North Slope are the key pieces of it. Every other aspect of it we believe in and we think is going to be a net positive for the state. But those are really the three linchpins of the whole bill. So that's, I guess, a long-winded way of saying, yes, I do believe this is the way forward. And it's a fluid situation in the state. We have 2 years, we have 5 years, we have 7 years, however many years you want to determine the direction the state goes after a piece of legislation like this passes is something we can do. It's now been almost 3.5, almost 4 years of ACEs. There are positives to it. The governor doesn't believe the whole thing should be thrown out. Representative Seaton makes a good point when he mentions the changes that have made have brought in new folks, independents taking a look at Alaska, and that's a positive thing. But we're also seeing an alarmingly low amount of exploration going on in the state as a result of it. And that's where we believe we are, a critical time in the state's history, opportunity to change the direction we're going. And like I said, it will play out the way it plays out. We will be analyzing it all along the way. If the bill passed today, you might not see a flood of money a year from today, but you could certainly have the industry come up a year from today and say, what's going on and where are we? And I think that would be healthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is it a quick one, Representative Gardner?
Yes, it is a quick one.
Representative Gardner.
When Brooks Range Petroleum was before us testifying on this bill, they expressed concern about language regarding unitized development and some provisions in this bill that they liked, but they would be excluded from because they were unitized before 12/31/2010. Is the administration going to propose any language to allow them to participate in those benefits? I think they're the only party that's impacted in that way.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we have had conversations about that in taking a look at that, and that's certainly something we're open to discussing with the committee in terms of making a change to the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. To that end, and Commissioner, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One of the things the Brooks Range Petroleum did bring to the table was the issue of they have a unit, and in fact there are several units throughout the state that do not have any production in them currently. And one of the things in conference with DNR and Revenue, this is an amendment that I want to just give to you for your consideration between now and Friday. We'll actually vote on the amendment on Friday. But basically what it does, and there may be some minor changes to it on Friday, but basically it's an attempt to encourage production in the essentially areas that aren't producing currently, and whether or not they're in a unit or not. So this would allow, even though it's in a unitized area, these unitized areas that were established after the date are basically non-producing areas. So this is an attempt to
address
that and to provide the incentive to the explorers involved to go develop as fast as they can and put as much more oil in the pipe as possible. Commissioner Butcher, thank you very much. In the course of all these various hearings, testimony by a wide range of companies, individuals, departments, I tried to take it apart as many different ways as I could. And I had consulted outside meetings here, a lot of different people in this room even. And I kept coming back to the governor's bill. It seems to be a very well-crafted piece of legislation. It seems to strike a good compromise between the revenue needs of the state and the trying to relax the fiscal terms of the state so that we do encourage more development and more production on the North Slope. I know there are several other amendments that are underway. We will need those amendments, if you want to have them considered on Friday. They will need to be in by 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And let's see. At this time, we also have three members that are excused from Friday's meeting. Representative Gardner, I believe, Representative Kawasaki, and Representative Herron. I'm going to go ahead and recess until 7 o'clock tonight. And when we come back, since you won't have the opportunity to talk about, I'd like to hear your opinions on the bill as it currently is or how you would propose to amend it, even if you don't have the language in front of you. And that way we at least we get your word in, since you won't be here on Friday.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can be prepared to do that. We have a mountain of material that I haven't yet had a chance to consider that were responses to questions from yesterday and the day before that I frankly haven't really had a chance to read through and understand and go back and forth and looking at the graphs and charts that give them meanings. And
that's fine,
I'm not prepared by 7 o'clock tonight.
Representative Herron?
If you wish, I'll be there at 7 o'clock.
Okay, thank you, Representative Herron.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Commissioner. We requested in writing a scenario on looking at how this would affect, because the fiscal note doesn't really take into account a major portion of the governor's bill, which is the 15% tax rate in the future. And that was looking at 7 years at a 7% decline, and at a best case scenario of that being replaced by new oil, and what that would then look like as a fiscal impact. So when you are able to, we'd like to, I haven't seen that yet unless it was in some of the paperwork that just showed up, but if we can have that by the next meeting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, it has been dropped off in your office, so you should have it.
Okay, thank you.
You got any other questions from the committee? Okay, it's 2:58. We will recess and reconvene here at after the majority caucus meeting, approximately 7 o'clock tonight.
We're shot with a 6 minute or 6 second delay. Can you imagine a 6 minute delay? Hello. Sometimes you can hear. Sometimes you can't. Can you hear it? There you go.
And the light is fixed. And
it's bright.
Oh. I'd like to call this resumption of the meeting of the House Resources Committee on, let's see, 23 February at 7:05 p.m. Members present, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Dick, Representative Herron, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, myself, Co-Chair Feige. On the sheet here that Lynn Hayes passed out to everybody is just a list of all those, sort of packet materials that were there before. You just might want to make sure that you have all those so that you're not missing anything. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does the Department of Revenue have any more information that they may be able to provide to us that's pending?
We've been joined by Representative Foster. Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Herron, we have, after the afternoon meeting, gotten together and compiled the questions, and we will get them to you as quickly as we can.
Okay. So there is essentially one more packet so far, Mr. Right. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Okay, with that, unless there are any other questions from committee members? Okay, we will meet Representative Dick.
If I could ask one, please.
Representative Dick.
And forgive me, I had a medical, I wouldn't have left. But as I'm visual, and I need to wrap my head around this. I saw four quadrants I built a lot of boats, and lacking a laboratory, I try the extreme, you know, too long, too wide, too short, too deep, and with that, I'm able to visualize. So as I'm trying to visualize this, if I could see those simultaneous equations that I described, if I could see that with one, in one quadrant, high prices and high development, you know how those two lines would go? Another one would be high prices and low development. And another would be low prices and high development, and the other would be low prices, low development. That would really help me visualize the worst and best case scenarios. I don't know. I wouldn't need a lot of accuracy. Even a graph or just an approximation would help me visualize. Because the question in my mind is, everybody's taking a chance in this. Mm. You know, we're all there's no. Nobody knows all the variables. So the question is, at what point out in the future, best case scenario, do we break even and then exceed the, if we leave it alone, this is where it's going to go. And at worst case scenario, then where is that? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see where that is in terms of distance from now when those two lines cross. In the best and worst case scenario, no, excuse me, not in best and worst, not where the two lines cross, but when our investment equals what the return. How many years out in the best and worst case scenarios? That would really help me visualize.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, excuse me, we will try to put that together for you. Mm-hmm. We talked at the department after the meeting about potentially what we could do that, you know, in terms of making assumptions, and there was a presentation by Great Bear on Friday, I believe, that gave their what they believed would occur with their company as a result of this bill passing. So we're going to look at putting that in a graph. You know, you can, to one person it's realistic, to another it's optimistic, to another it's pessimistic. We won't determine what your view is on that, but we will graph it out and say, okay, this is what they presented, and here's how it would look in our tax under this bill, and give you an idea about where that puts us. But we're going to prepare that, and then we'll look into what you just asked for and see what we can do with that as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Following up on that, are you're looking, I'm just trying to figure out, you're looking at the status quo revenue source book for the oil projection production as being status quo, and a change from that production would be what you would be looking at as the effect of this bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. We would keep the same assumptions on oil price out into the future. We would keep the same assumptions on production forecast, and then we would incorporate what might be an increase in production as a result of the passage of the bill.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
And so when you're doing that, I presume that you will also do a graph of cumulative revenue to the state and the differences of that as you go forward. Is that fairly easy to accomplish as well?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yeah, we will try to give a side-by-side of where we think, where we would expect to be into the status quo, and then where we would be as a result of the bill passing.
Okay. Okay, just a reminder to members to have amendments for Friday in by 1 o'clock tomorrow to my office. And on Friday, we will meet again at Friday at 1 o'clock here in this room. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.